This episode is brought to you in collaboration with Sweet Girl Farm, a small woman-owned apothecary dedicated to health from the inside out. Get 10% off your order at sweetgirlfarm.com with the code CHICKENLADY. Welcome back to the Feminist Book Club podcast, a show for dangerous, well-read women. Each week, we explore literature and media through a feminist lens as one small way to reclaim our time, our books, and our stories. Let's get started. Hi, everyone. Renee Powers here. Thank you for bearing with me on this delayed episode. It's a day late, and I am so sorry. We had some technical issues on our end, plus, honestly, the underlying anxiety that the coronavirus has caused definitely necessitated some extra time to tend to my own mental health. Because I am so lucky to have people who listen all over the world, I want to take a moment to let you know that I am thinking of all of you. Whether you're feeling the effects of this virus yet or not, know that you are not alone. Please take extra precautions, as many as you can, to help slow the spread of this disease. I will be working from home for the foreseeable future, and if you have the privilege of doing the same, it's a great idea. I've been very open about my own mental health struggles, and this is certainly taking its toll. So, from one severely anxious person to another, be mindful of the things you can do to mitigate your anxiety. For me, that's working from home, getting extra sleep, eating nutrient-rich foods, seeing my therapist, making sure my pantry is stocked with staples, staying away from my elderly in-laws, and limiting my errands. Do what you gotta do for yourself and your community. We are all in this together. My hope is that Feminist Book Club becomes a place where you can tune out all of the stress and anxiety and lose yourself in a good conversation. I have found so much solace in books this week, and so I hope you find solace in this too. I have lots of other announcements today, so this episode will be a bit longer than usual. So first, as expected, many of the events we were participating in have been canceled or postponed. As of now, the Twin Cities Women's Expo is postponed, and the Wordplay Festival will be shifting to a virtual event. The book tour that I'm moderating with Jen Gotch for her new book, The Upside of Being Down, is still on the schedule as of today, March 13th. That is scheduled for Friday, March 27th. I will keep you posted if anything changes there, as well as with BookCon in New York at the end of May. It is also still on the schedule, and we are also still planning to be there. Keep an eye on your email and your social media. We will make announcements that way. If things are feeling extra heavy for you today, then you will be happy to hear that our April Book of the Month is a queer young adult book about witches. I encouraged our members to suggest titles on the theme of women and nature and to interpret that theme in whichever way feels right to them. So we voted on those suggestions, and our main character of this book is an elemental witch with the ability to control fire, earth, water, and air. Very cool. So I suppose I should tell you what book it is, right? Our April book is called These Witches Don't Burn by Isabel Sterling. So sign up between now and April 6th to be a part of this month's discussion. Our April box will also feature a gorgeous facial serum from today's sponsor, Sweet Girl Farm. Founder Christina is a master gardener turned herbalist who is passionate about health from the inside out. Her facial serum features botanicals that fight inflammation and green tea for UV damage and aging skin. I love a good facial serum. I am so pleased and so excited to be sharing this with all of you. Everyone loves her products, from adults to children and even her chickens. She has 30 hens on her farm. So try it out for yourself. Join us for April at feministbookclub.com or use the code CHICKENLADY for 10% off at sweetgirlfarm.com. Our April box in honor of Earth Day and Earth Month will feature lots of sustainable, reusable products, so stay tuned for more reveals here and on our Instagram. Today's interview is with Andy Zeisler, author of our book of the month, We Were Feminists Once. You can still join us for March. The box is available as a one-time purchase in our shop. I think I've got 8 left over. So head over to feministbookclub.com/shop and pick up one of those 8 boxes. This conversation is perfect for all of our feminist theory loving babes out there. We take a deep dive into some theoretical concepts and how they apply to our everyday lives. And we do it through the lens of pop culture, so do not fret, there is something for everyone here. Enjoy. Hi, everyone. Today, I'm so excited to be talking to Andy Zeisler. Andy is the co-founder and creative director of Bitch Media. Her writing has appeared in Ms., Mother Jones, Salon, Bust, and the San Francisco Chronicle and the Washington Post. She's the author of Feminism and Pop Culture, as well as our March Book of the Month, We Were Feminists Once, From Riot Girl to Cover Girl, The Buying and Selling of a Political Movement. Welcome, Andy.
Thanks for having me. And just one small correction. I'm actually no longer the creative director of Bitch. I'm now like just listed as co-founder and I sort of do a little bit of everything. So,
well, thank you for letting me know. I think co-founder is definitely the powerful part of it anyways. So the question that I ask, and I think it's going to be interesting because you tackle this question in your book, but I ask every guest right off the bat, what do you define as feminism?
Well, I'm a big fan of a kind of slightly amplified version of the dictionary definition, which is, you know, the economic, social, and political equality of the sexes. But, you know, I would add, and the acknowledgement that these are different once you add the sort of intersectional oppressions that go into them. So it's really the acknowledgement of the economic and social and political equality of the sexes, as well as of the sort of cultural and historical forces that have marginalized different kinds of women.
So I appreciate a very classic definition of feminism, because as you say, in this book, that when we define feminism individually, we're doing a disservice to the movement. Would I be correct in that characterization?
Oh, yeah. And I mean that, you know, that was certainly a big part of the impetus for writing the book, was the idea that there seemed to be this belief that you could, if you were a woman, define feminism as whatever you wanted it to be. And my feeling was, well, you know what? It already has a definition. You know, you can, I guess, add your own personal experience to that. But I felt like there was a way in which people, especially when talking to celebrities, were basically, you know, saying, this word already has a definition, but how do you experience it? And I just felt like that is absolutely the wrong question. And it really sort of led to a lot of women kind of justifying actions or words that were, you know, explicitly anti the premise and spirit of feminism, and then casting that as feminism, you know, like, actually, women who are pro-choice are not feminist. It's the pro-life women who are feminist, or like, you know, versions of that. Certainly the sort of morphing of feminism into a series of individual choices was part of that, part of ignoring the way that feminism has had a perfectly good definition for, you know, decades.
I want to get to the discussion of choice feminism in a moment, but for our audience who hasn't read this yet, and again, this is our book of the month, so this would be anybody who's not a member of Feminist Book Club, give us just a summary of the arguments in this book and introduce us to the book.
Yeah. Well, the book, it sort of traces the way that feminism became, over a fairly quick period of time in the 2010s, a period of time when feminism became trendy and when feminism became accepted not for its ethics and its projects and its, you know, goals, but as a way to sort of identify yourself, an individual kind of feminism that attracted a certain social cachet, and then the way that media and pop culture forces kind of leveraged that to sell things. So it really was about, what does feminism look like when it becomes more of an identity than a sort of political frame or a way to look at the world?
And you do this through the lens of pop culture. And I know pop culture has always been an interest of yours, and Bitch Magazine has always had kind of a pop culture bent too. So why that route? Why did you want to use pop culture as the vehicle to discuss these issues?
Well, a lot of it was the fact that, yeah, Bitch was founded, you know, our tagline is a feminist response to pop culture. Bitch was founded in the mid-1990s, before the internet, before social media, as a way to highlight pop culture as the locus of a lot of feminist thought and even feminist activism. Our goal really was to encourage ourselves and others to think critically about the messages and the narratives of media and popular culture and how they really impacted all aspects of life, anything having to do with gender and power and race and opportunity. Those are the stories we hear. So I think at some point in starting to think about the way that feminism had become weirdly popular, I felt like as someone who really had touted and centered the potential of popular culture to sort of reinvigorate and energize new feminist movements, I felt a little bit implicated in, you know, the way that pop culture and media had done that. It was very much of like, no, 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 not like this. This is not what we were talking about. But of course, that's how it does get filtered into the mainstream, is through celebrities, is through sort of surface level understandings of feminism, and especially is through products. When, you know, when you can sell something by making the case that to purchase that thing is a feminist purchase, then it becomes consumption, becomes an act of resistance. And a focus on that then allows consumerism rather than activism to become the focus of feminism.
And that is what you call marketplace feminism, this act of purchasing one's empowerment. And you take the term empowerment to task too, which I just love. And I'm so glad that you said that you felt implicated by being a magazine for pop culture. And because reading this, I read this kind of at arm's length, like, oh God, this is a book that's going to tell me that feminism and capitalism can never, ever coexist, and it's not worth even trying. And here I am running a business called Feminist Book Club. And I knew I'd be talking to you, and I was thinking, oh, I hope she doesn't think that I'm just like trying to make a buck off of feminism. That's my own baggage. I don't need to prove that to anybody. But I think I want to go to that question. Can feminism and capitalism coexist?
I mean, I think that's really the eternal question, that feminism itself has not been able to answer one way or the other, because we're in it. It doesn't matter, like, if we are not able to live as people, as humans, outside the structure of capitalism, which is a very, very different. You can live off the grid. You could possibly, you know, sort of survivalist style, not interact with capitalism. But that also means that your voice doesn't get out there to talk about things like why capitalism and feminism are inherently incompatible. So I think it's something that all social movements, as long as there have been social movements, have dealt with. You know, how do you get your message out without the help of the mainstream, without the help of, you know, surrogates and spokespeople who might be celebrities, they might be politicians, they might be whoever, but they are people that other people listen to. And so this has always been a challenge. It's always been a challenge to make a political movement resonate with a lot of people who might not otherwise interact with it. It's impossible to do that without being part of it, without buying into part of it. And I think it's okay, and I think it's necessary to be able to sort of hold two very true concepts at once. One, which is that, you know, feminism and capitalism have always had an uneasy relationship, that has certainly not benefited feminism. But on the other hand, the message is important enough, and the desire to encourage people to think critically enough requires you to be out there and to you know, sell a book, or, you know, get people to listen to a podcast. Like, it's really the question that I think will always be central to people who organize around social movements and people who are activists.
Yeah. I also want to just note that it requires a lot of privilege to remove yourself from systems like capitalism, to go off the grid, to be a survivalist. I mean, I think Ron Swanson right off the bat. And I think that character is kind of an archetype of what that kind of privilege looks like as a white guy, for lack of better language. And folks that don't have those kinds of privileges, systemic privileges, can't necessarily just move to the woods and peace out and opt out of capitalism. It's not an option. Therefore, capitalism is compulsory for so many of us. And how do we do it mindfully, I think, is the question that I ask myself a lot. So let's change gears and talk about, I pulled out three different kinds of feminisms that you take to task. And we already mentioned choice feminism. So I want to talk about that. I also want to talk about marketplace feminism and then post-feminism as well, because full disclosure, my master's thesis was on post-feminism. So it was nice to revisit that. It's been a long time. So where would you like to start with those?
I mean, I'm happy to let you lead this discussion.
Okay. So we've already mentioned that choice feminism is this idea that every choice that you make is a feminist one because you are a woman who can make these choices now. But that's not necessarily true. And tell us why that's problematic to think.
Right. Well, so I want to give credit where it's due. There's a historian and philosopher named Linda Hirschman who in the early aughts wrote a manifesto called Get to Work. And it was basically talking to educated, privileged women and telling them that as educated, privileged women, they should not be squandering the privilege that they have by, you know, staying at home to raise kids when we do not ask the same of their husbands or their grown sons. The idea that women, by virtue of being women, should always be the ones to drop out of the workforce to take care of kids, it doesn't make sense. It's an outdated idea. So this book came out and there was such an uproar. It became part of what at the time everyone called the mommy wars, which was this kind of ginned up conflict between working mothers and stay-at-home mothers who, again, both of whom were, you know, these sort of educated, privileged women who had the liberty to make that choice to, for instance, stop working after having a child. And it was really, it was like catnip for the media. It was this idea that like women are fighting and it's because of their own choices. It has nothing to do with a matrix of patriarchy and expectation and gendered assumptions. Like the idea that this was a strictly individual choice that these two groups of women were making was a way to have conversations that were about feminism without talking about feminism as a collective movement. So it really was putting all the emphasis on women's individual choices without acknowledging the, you know, the ways those choices are shaped, not just by, you know, society and, you know, politics, but by actual workplace policies. You know, a lot of women who were doing what the media called opting out were actually not opting out. They were giving up because their workplaces were not allowing for them to work and also be parents. There was absolutely no balance. It was like, okay, well, if you can't work 80 hours a week, you might as well quit. So there really was this fiction that was trumpeted by the media because it sold a lot of magazines and it got a lot of traffic. This idea that what we were talking about choice and not about the way that choice is constrained by, you know, material conditions. And so, you know, it's not that was the first time that people had sort of used the frame of choice to talk about feminism, but it was a way of sort of obfuscating the fact that, you know what, we've had all these feminist movements, and the one thing we have not been able to address, because we just won't address it, is the fact that domestic life is still skewed largely in favor of men and fathers. And no one wants to admit that. So it becomes a thing that you have to sort of skirt around. And choice is one of the, you know, key ways to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. So choice feminism in pop culture, what does that look like?
Well, I mean, I think the example I used and the example Linda used, and I think the most prominent example was Sex and the City, when Charlotte quits her job at a gallery, which, you know, she loves, which has defined her life. And Miranda, who is, of course, the sort of hard-charging career lady, tells her that she might regret it because once she's ready to come back, she won't be in the game anymore. She will have, you know, sort of given up her position and won't be able to get it back. And not that that's fair. Like, Miranda wasn't saying that's fair, but she was saying that's the reality. And so the upshot of that conversation was Charlotte just screaming, "I choose my choice. I choose my choice." And it was this idea of like, how do you justify doing something that it's clear is not about equality, not about liberating all women, but is a purely individual choice that is guided by patriarchy? You know, how do you justify that to yourself and others? And the way you do it is by calling it choice and by emphasizing that nothing, you made it in a vacuum, like nothing had anything to do with it. So I think that very quickly, certainly among media feminism types that have been my circle, was to kind of, you know, mockingly quote Charlotte whenever we were very conscious of doing something that departed from what we think of as like feminist praxis. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think part of why choice feminism has been a really alluring prospect to people who would not identify themselves as sort of like movement feminists is the idea that it truly is about choice. It's like, you know, this long buffet table that you can sort of walk down and pick the parts, pick the things you like, and then sort of reverse engineer them into a philosophy, you know? So it's like you walk down the table and it's like, well, I'm going to give up my job and here's why that's feminist. I'm going to put one of those weird little headbands on my baby so everyone knows it's a girl, even though no one cares. Like, that, this is why that's feminist. I'm going to watch The Bachelor. This is why that's feminist. And my feeling was like, why do you want to twist yourself into a pretzel to justify these things and not instead sort of indict the system that makes women be faced with impossible choices? It just really spoke to a reluctance to talk about all the ways that we have not changed as a society, as a culture, as, you know, a body politic.
And I think that leads us to a discussion of post-feminism too, which is this assumption that feminism's goals have all been achieved, therefore we don't need feminism anymore, therefore, again, every decision I make is a feminist decision, or every choice that I make is a feminist choice. And I think that to me, one of the tenets of post-feminism is also, and choice feminism is also, holding up as ideal the individual that individual always trumps the collective. Would you agree with that characterization of post-feminism?
Definitely, but I also think you can't really talk about post-feminism without talking about the sort of larger construct of individual over collective, which is, you know, neoliberalism and this idea that we don't need the government to provide. The markets will provide. The markets will tell us what to do. And that is something that, you know, I grew up in the 1980s after Reagan became president, when neoliberalism became the sort of prevailing belief system. And this idea that depending on the government or, you know, collective struggle was suddenly weakness, just sort of grew stronger and stronger as economics started reflecting this idea that privatization was the only way to sort of make progress. Yeah, and I, you know, I started noticing this a lot around the time I started writing this book, because Barack Obama, like the part of his background that I saw so many conservative pundits trashing was his background as a community organizer. It's like, in what world is that bad? You know what I mean? Like, it's bad in a neoliberal world where we have decided that no one should depend on anyone besides themselves. So, yeah, I mean, I think so much of what we think of as sort of normal in this world and under capitalism is really, really reflects this idea that anything that requires collective struggle is not worth it, is weak, is, you know, will keep you poor or whatever. It doesn't align with what we think about ourselves as a country, which is that, you know, we're independent. We pull ourselves up from our bootstraps. Like, it is something that, you know, certainly no one seems to have any, you know, financial incentive to embrace these days.
Which is where marketplace feminism comes in. I love that we just effortlessly found these transitions.
It's all connected, is the thing.
Exactly. I think we could have started anywhere and made our way to where we needed to go. So neoliberalism relies on this assumption that the market will take care of the individual, and therefore, fill in the blank, marketplace feminism is?
Marketplace feminism is just leveraging the sort of language and imagery and purported goals of feminism, not toward justice-focused ends, but toward commercial ends. And yeah, I mean, it's...
It's dangerous.
It's dangerous. And it's always existed on some level, which is something I talk about in the book. You know, as long as there have been feminist movements, particularly ones led by white women, there have been people trying to profit off of them, and in many cases succeeding really well. And I think that is certainly, you know, what we were seeing at the time I was writing this book. And frankly, even more so several months after it came out and Trump was elected. It's really funny because when I was writing the book, I was like, you know, this is going to be like environmentalism. Like, it's going to be a hot topic. Everyone's going to love it. There's going to be green carpets instead of red carpets at film premieres. And then, you know, it's just something else is going to come along and replace it as kind of like the social trend of the time. And I certainly was not counting on a president like Donald Trump being elected. But in the wake of that, marketplace feminism sort of became inescapable. I remember in the weeks before the women's marches, I was getting press releases that were like, we are the official lipstick of the women's march. And the colors are pantsuit pink and, like, you know, revolutionary red. And, you know, this was being done in all seriousness. And it inevitably was a sort of way to turn stereotypically feminine trappings into feminist statements and thus not require anyone to sort of think too deeply about what it was. It was like, well, I'm going to wear lipstick anyway. I might as well wear this pantsuit pink lipstick. So, you know, and that just became the sort of dominant mode of thinking about feminism. And, you know, over time, it just started to feel like, well, if a woman is doing this, it must by definition be feminism, which just really sort of skips over so many steps. But it was like the country really needed something to grasp onto, and it was very close and it was very simple to do so.
Now we're in this social context of a marketplace feminism, and we're gearing up towards another election, and we're recording this the day that Elizabeth Warren suspended her presidential bid, and everybody that I've talked to is just devastated. But in her post on Medium that she shared, it was the transcript of what she shared with her campaign staff. She mentioned the proliferation of Liberty Green, which was the color of her campaign signs, and it was just kind of her campaign brand was this Liberty Green. And this reminds me so much of that, is we're seeing, you know, I want to support Warren. And I was thinking, how can I do that? Well, I wish I had some like shirt that was, mm-hmm. you know, this mint green that I could wear in solidarity. And so what do we do? What do we do in this social context of marketplace feminism, wherein we want to participate, we want to share solidarity? Sometimes it feels like you said, the easiest way to do that is to purchase products. And I think this is just one of those snake eating its own tail that we're kind of in this space where I'm working it out loud right now. Like, we're in this space where we want to participate, we want to support, and we don't really know how outside of the constraints of capitalism.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly it. And let me just disclose that I bought two of those Liberty Green bumper stickers.
Absolutely. Yeah. I know what my favorite nail polish company has, a Liberty Green nail polish that
I didn't know it had a name. I just liked it, and I wanted a Warren bumper sticker to cover my IDK, not Trump though, 2016 bumper sticker, because I feel like it is not going over well in some parts of where I live. But yeah, I think there's a lot of nuance to this conversation about what it means to sort of engage with marketplace feminism. And I think, you know, Warren merch is a good example, because, you know, to me, it's sort of like, why does this thing exist? And does it exist to create a message, or does it exist to exploit a trend? And there's obviously things that, you know, really skirt that line. But certainly, and especially, I have to say this as, you know, the co-founder of a product, which is a magazine and a website and things that people pay for, I think, you know, if you are supporting something that is a sort of means to an end, in the sense of that is sort of participating in a mode of communication and discourse and activism toward a greater whole, that is one thing. It's another thing to say, well, women are going to buy lipstick anyway, so let's capitalize on that by, you know, naming the lipsticks after, you know, Hillary Clinton's pantsuit, or like there was one that was like an anti-Trump red or something like that. I'm telling you, there were like three different companies. So it's sort of like, does this exist toward an end that is more than capitalism, or does it exist because something like it already exists and people want to, you know, make a dime off it? Yeah. And it's not to say that those people don't believe in feminism. It's not to say that small business owners creating whatever aren't expressing feminism in the way that resonates with them. But my feeling is sort of like, you do have to sort of look at it on a case-by-case basis. You also have to look at where it's coming from. If you have a company like Nike, for instance, which for a long time has sort of leveraged not explicitly feminism, but like ideas of strength and power and women and like the potential of girls. You know, they've been doing that for a long time very successfully. But when you sort of look at Nike as a business and how its workers are treated and, you know, how much it pays the women in the Global South who are, you know, a big part of the workforce that makes these things, like, there are pretty easy ways to see who is kind of walking the walk with those things. And yeah, so there's definitely a big difference between a company like Nike saying, okay, let's get on this feminist train again. Or, you know, Gillette being like, well, how can we make our shaving cream sound feminist? There's a big difference between that and, you know, people who are starting like an Etsy shop selling t-shirts with quotes from famous actual feminists on them. And I think one of the things about marketplace feminism that I've tried to be really careful with is not lumping it all together and also not shaming people for participating in it, because, you know, you have to meet people where they're at. And sometimes where they're at is, you know, Donald Trump's election being the wake-up call that shows them that feminism is not something that happened and that is in the past, you know?
And that's, I think the unsaid thing there is that's a lot of white privileged women.
For sure. Yes. Yeah.
So I am so glad we got to all of these like big, meaty, theoretical, but theoretical in practice things. And, but we also have to note that this book was written 4 years ago.
Yeah.
So what would you add to it or change in the last 4 years?
Well, I mean, I do think marketplace feminism and, you know, the dimension of that, that sort of put the spotlight on feminist celebrities who were, you know, donating to feminist causes or the spokespeople for ideology that we would call feminist. I think that there has been, again, I'm likening this to environmentalism because it's sort of the same thing. Like, yes, people, you know, magazines stopped doing green issues, but, you know, it's not like everyone stopped recycling when that happened. It's like we had our consciousness raised. We realized that there were things we could do. We realized that there was a way in which our consumption was contributing to a problem. And a lot of us adjusted to it. And a lot of, you know, there was systemic change in many cases. There were, you know, entire cities that instituted recycling programs and things like that. So we have seen lasting benefits. And I think the same is true with feminism and, you know, with marketplace feminism. I think a lot of people who were not familiar with feminism and who, like I said before, really thought of feminism as something that was historical, that did not apply to them, realize that in fact, the issues that feminist movements have always tried to address are still very much with us, especially as we get more and more entrenched in capitalism. You know, and we see the fact that low-income women are often the people with the least freedom and the least ability to make choices. And so I do think marketplace feminism has had a hand in sort of shifting that spotlight, even if it just comes from people critiquing marketplace feminism. You know what I mean? So there's that. But I think one of the things that I would want to add if I, you know, updated the book or wrote it now is the way that we have almost made feminism, again, less about a lens on subjects and more as a sort of metric by which people, in particular women, talk about what is okay for them to consume. Sorry, I took such a long time getting there, but...
No, I love this conversation. And you start to dabble in it in your book too, mm-hmm. when you bring up the Bechdel test. And yeah. The Bechdel test was never meant to be a metric of whether or not a film is feminist.
Exactly.
It was a mechanism to talk about how the film industry as a whole has silenced the voices and stories of women.
Yeah. And so, you know, as someone who speaks pretty frequently on college campuses about feminism, I have found myself so often being asked, like, well, but is it okay if I like Game of Thrones? Is that at odds with my feminism? And it's sort of like, this is not, this shouldn't be, like, I understand why this is where our minds sort of go, but, you know, that's not the right question. I mean, there are a lot of good questions that come out of the question of, like, what does it mean to be a feminist who really enjoys, you know, something like Game of Thrones or something where women are represented in really, you know, harmful ways or really exploitative ways. There's a way to talk about, you know, why we expect that, why that is such a theme of so much of our popular culture. But feminism is not the arbiter of what you're allowed to do. It is not something where, you know, someone's going to show up at your door and be like, well, you watched 5 episodes of Game of Thrones over the weekend. We're going to have to take away your feminist card, or like, we're going to come and collect all your feminist theory books. But I feel like that is a way that people sort of process social movements. And again, it comes down to sort of an individual thing. Like, is it going to harm feminism as a whole if you continue consuming like R. Kelly albums or, you know, something like that? No, but it's also an opportunity to sort of interrogate how women consumers in particular often don't have any options. And so we see ourselves through the pop culture products that are out there and that are up until recently just overwhelmingly created by white men, and that, you know, put forth a lot of harmful ideas about people who aren't white men. So yeah, I mean, I think that is something that certainly frustrated me over the past 4 years. Another thing that has frustrated me also in the realm of pop culture is the idea that if a woman makes a film or is involved in a film or stars in a film, that film is like de facto feminist. And then we have to go from there and start chipping away at all the things that weren't feminist about it. Like, I think, you know, the Wonder Woman film is like a really good example. Captain Marvel, really good example. Like, we hear the word woman, especially when it's paired with like the word strong or superhero. And we assume somehow that it's going to be feminist. And I think that's a mistake to start from there. And unfortunately, that seems to be kind of the dominant way we talk about so much pop culture now, is like equating the word woman with the word feminist. And as we all know, that is not a thing you can do. You know, 53% of white women voted for Donald Trump. Like, we should know better than to, you know, conflate those things. And yet it happens all the time. It happens even in Bitch. I find myself, you know, copy editing things and being like, okay, why is this a feminist TV show? Are you saying it's a feminist TV show because it stars a woman, because it's written by women? Like, can we break this down and talk about these sort of equations that we make and how we set them up to fail by doing so?
Yeah. And full disclosure, Wonder Woman makes me cry happy feminist tears every time I watch her run into battle, but that's a whole discussion in itself. But okay, so I have taken way too much of your time. Thank you for going all these directions with me. We wrap up with the same two questions. The first is, do you have a book to recommend that is not your own that our audience should check out?
It's really funny because I listened to the interview you did with Megan Angelo, who wrote Followers, and I just finished that because Bitch has a book club, not as like cool and subscription oriented, but like that's our book club pick.
It's for so this good. Time.
And it's so good. Yeah. So I actually have not been reading a ton of fiction over the past few years, and I find myself getting into it a lot more now. So besides Followers, I read a book called Such a Fun Age by a woman named Kylie Reed. Did you read it?
Also amazing. Yeah.
I mean, I whipped through that book. Mm-hmm. I just couldn't stop reading it. I just thought it was such a smart and pointed thing that sort of incorporated a lot of the stuff that, you know, you discuss and that Bitch discusses about, you know, women and assumptions and power and all these things. So loved it.
Yeah, those are two. I will co-sign both of those recommendations. I've talked about them both on the show. They are excellent. And I'm in a feud with Reese Witherspoon. She doesn't know about this, but I'm in a feud with Reese Witherspoon because I wanted to get Kylie on the show to talk about Such a Fun Age. And then Reese chose her book as her book club pick. And then Kylie's publicity schedule went bonkers.
Well, not very feminist of Reese.
Right.
I'm just kidding.
Exactly. Yeah. Come at me. Okay. The last question I ask is, if we want to connect further with you, what's the best way to do that online?
Bitchmedia.org is, you know, our site, and it is certainly a way to connect with all parts of Bitch, me personally, if necessary. Also on Twitter, where I am just Andy Zeisler, all lowercase.
Perfect. I will put those in the show notes. Thank you so, so much for joining me today. This has been such a just a pleasure and a little baby feminist dream come true too.
Thank you for having me. It was really fun. I love especially talking about books. So,
same.
So great. What you're doing. I just love the idea that you're doing this. So.
Thank you. We'll talk soon.
Okay. Bye.
Thanks for listening to today's show. As always, a rating and review in the podcast app of your choice goes a long way in supporting feminist media. We'd love to have you join the Feminist Book Club subscription box, a community-driven subscription box which features a book of the month and products from women and queer-owned businesses delivered directly to your doorstep. This is an easy way to vote with your dollars, as you'll be supporting this podcast, small women and queer-owned businesses, and the charity beneficiary of the month, which receives 5% of total sales. Use code PODCAST for a discount on any subscription package. Learn more about the box and get the show notes for today's episode at feministbookclub.com. See you next time.
A well-read woman is a thing.